This on the back is an excerpt from something Dogen wrote called Gakudo Yo Jinshu, Practical Advice on Pursuing the Truth, Buddhist Truth. It's quite a short document, but it's written in, I only want to look at the whole thing that's here. It's written in 10 sections. It's quite interesting. And the version here is translated by Nishijima, Roshi and Mike. And I think it's on the website. Maybe. If not, we should put it there. So I just took this one section from it. Section 8. The other sections are in order. Establish the will to the truth, number one. Number two, when you meet and listen to the authentic teachings of Gautama Buddha, be sure to learn them through practice. Number three, enter into and experience Buddhism, always rely on practice. Number four, do not practice Gautama Buddha's teachings with the intention of getting something. Number five, to practice Zazen and study the truth, look for a true master. Oh, this is number five. Number six, what we should know in practicing Zazen. Number seven, any person who hungers to practice Buddhism and to transcend secular society should without fail practice Zazen. Number eight, about the conduct of Buddhist priests and nuns who practice Zazen. Number nine, direct yourself at the truth and practice it. Number 10, taking a direct hit here and now. Hitting the target here and now. I'll leave it out if anybody wants to browse it. I just took one thing out of it. At random, actually. To practice Zazen and study the truth, look for a true master. An ancient master said, if the establishment of the will to the truth is not right, then all practices will come to nothing. Establishment of the will to the truth. Will to the truth is from the Sanskrit bodhicitta, or Buddha mind. But my teacher would translate it as the will to the truth. It's some kind of quality which we have, which makes us look for our original nature. And Nishijima Roshi used to say, children have it. We call it curiosity. But we bang it out of them, of course, so that they can fit into society. Because it wouldn't be much good to have lots and lots of people all living in big cities, all very, very curious about what the truth is. It wouldn't really work, so we need to get it out of them. But children have got it, usually. So, you've got to establish the will to the truth, and if you don't, then whatever you do won't have any value. How true these words are. And we should also know that practicing the truth depends on whether the master is true or not. The student is like a fine wood, and the master is like a carpenter. Quality wood will not show its beauty unless it is in the hands of a good carpenter, whereas in the hands of a real craftsman, even warped wood will show its quality at once. The truth or falsity of enlightenment lies in the rightness or wrongness of the master. We can understand the fact with this simile. No comment. In the whole history of Japan, however, until now there have been no true masters. How do we know this? We can know it by reading what past teachers have said, just as we can find out the source of a river by scooping out water downstream. So Master Dogen, having come back from China, had the boldness to say there are no true masters in Japan. Which is quite a bold thing to say, really.
Must have made him popular.
Pardon?
Must have made him popular with all the...
Yes, they pushed him out onto the into the forests of Echizen and tried to burn his temple down. So he's a popular guy. In our country, from ancient times until today, although many teachers have edited books, taught students, preached to human beings and gods in heaven, their words were green and their speech was immature. They never arrived at the upper limits of intellectual study. So how could they ever have reached even the boundary of real experience? They just passed on words and phrases and made their disciples recite names of Buddha. Night and day they would count the treasures of others without being able to get half a penny for themselves. That was the blunder of the ancient masters in Japan. Wow. Mm-hmm. So he's very critical. And the reason he can be critical is because he spent from the ages of 11 to 27 trying to find what the truth of Buddhism was in Japan. And although he met masters here and there, and nobody could answer his very simple questions. And when he found out what the truth of Buddhism, as he puts it, was, he could see very clearly that what was going on in Japan was not true Buddhism. So it's very much couched in terms of Buddhism, because Dogen was living in a time when, the name isn't Buddhism in Japanese, it's Butsudo, the Buddhist path. It's not an ism. The Japanese word doesn't have that connection. In English, an ism makes it into some kind of teaching with a large abstract content. Ism makes a noun abstract normally. We don't say swimism, we say swimming. So Buddhism. Waking up. In his writings, he talks so much about what we translate as Buddhism that it's easy to think that the truth only exists within what people call Buddhism. And that's really wrong. And it's really a mistake. And I think lots of groups that call themselves Buddhist groups make the mistake of believing that what is true only exists within the teachings they're studying, and often within their group, and sometimes even within the small group of people within their group. And if you contribute in the right way and do the right things, you can get a bit of it too. Well, I think that the modern world has developed to way beyond anything that Dogen could imagine, and the truth of what is Dogen calls the truth of Buddhism no longer exists only within Buddhism. And Dogen himself says in parts of the Shobogenzo, the truth exists, quoting from the Lotus Sutra, the truth exists everywhere. In trees, walls, everywhere. And he also quotes stories which says animals can teach us, and so on. So people who think that the truth exists in Buddhism, in the modern world, I'm afraid are limiting their ability to learn. I feel that very strongly. So where should we look for a true master then? He goes on criticizing. Some of these masters in Japan taught others to seek enlightenment that was different from a concrete mental state. And some of them taught others to look forward to life in another world. Delusion, confusion, and wrong ideas sprang from these teachings. It is like when bad doctors prescribe medicine. For example, if the medicine itself is good, unless the doctor tells his patient how to take it, the medicine may be more harmful than the poison. There's never been anyone in this country who could administer medicine effectively. And until now, there's been no master who could give any antidote for the bad medicine. For this reason, people have struggled to avoid life and sickness. But how can anyone escape aging and death? That people have tried to do so was completely the fault of the teachers. The students were not to blame at all. So he's really lambasting the state of affairs in Japan when he got back. And it's interesting, until now there's been no master. Suggests that he's saying that he can give the antidote for the bad medicine.
What sort of kind of things would you have been talking about? Like sort of endless amounts of lists of...
Esoteric. Buddhist groups did esoteric practices. Mm. Buddhist groups that did ascetic practices, who thought that reciting the Buddha's name would give us some kind of special merit. Groups that believed that you were reincarnated. Groups that believed that there was some special state that the teacher got, that you could get if you tried hard enough. All of those.
And a lot of it's still going on.
It is, isn't it? Yes, isn't it? Still going on. It's been passed carefully down.
Yeah.
Because it's very attractive. It's very attractive to find somebody who you can believe in, who says, you know, if you try hard and do what I'm doing, you can become special, and you can have a special life, and you can know special things, and you can be very happy, and all those kind of things. It's attractive. People are attracted to it. He goes on to say, why do I say so? Why do I say that it's the fault of the teachers, not the students? Because these things happen when teachers make their students discard basics in favour of trivialities. Trivialities, he means embroidery, really. Before they have any real understanding of their own, such teachers become exclusively absorbed in making their own selfish mind vigorous, while all around them others are falling down into the wrong state. It is so pitiful. The teachers themselves have never understood this wrongness and delusion, so how could their disciples be expected to know right and wrong? It is very regrettable that Gautama Buddha's teachings have never spread to this small country, far from civilized nations, that's Japan, and that no true master has ever appeared. If you want to study the supreme Buddhist truth, you have to visit excellent Buddhist masters in far off China, which is what he did. Reflect upon the vigorous road that is far beyond intellectual thinking. If you cannot find a true master, it's better not to study at all. Generally, in looking for a true master, don't worry about age or experience. A true master is just someone who has realized the true teachings and received the certification of a true master. Knowledge of words is not important. Understanding is not primary. Wow. A man of extraordinary power and unrestricted mental vigor, who transcends his own opinion, who does not linger in states of emotional consciousness, and in whom practice and understanding meet in equilibrium. This is just a true master. Wow. That's what he wrote.
Would it have been sort of gendered in original Japanese? It feels awfully male.
Yeah, it is awfully male, yes.
Is that kind of... is that a translation issue?
No,
it's in the original.
It's original, yeah. In later works, he does... There's one chapter he wrote specifically saying that men and women are equal, and that we shouldn't look upon, men shouldn't look upon women as sexual objects, and that a woman can be a master as well as a man. But in the rest of the book, it's patriarch,
mm-hmm.
and so on. So that's just the way he wrote.
Is that because, you know, like English, it's just you have to use one of the pronouns and it's easier to, you know, you're just going with one and he's just going with the male rather than having to say like he, she, as you'd have the same problem in English.
Is that why he did it?
No, yeah, would that, you know, would you have faced, is that... Does Japanese kind of work in the same way, faced with the same problem, where it's a bit clunky to have to say he, she all the time?
Yes, gender-specific words.
But it was also patriarchal, and society still is, isn't it? Where women are, you know, like ornaments a lot of the time.
Yes.
And why Japanese women like meeting and marrying Westerners, because they... treat them more as equals, not as these dainty little...
Maybe true.
Well, I've heard certain women have.
Yeah.
So was this written before the show began, or...?
No, this is... Oh, I'm not sure when it was written, actually. I think it was written in parallel with it. Although I'd have to look that up, Mark.
Because it's very direct, isn't it? I mean, the language is much more direct and simple than the poetic language of a lot of the shobegenza.
Master Dogen came back from China to Japan in 1227, when he was 27 years old. In the following years, he wrote several books: Fukan Zazengi, The Guide to the Standard Method of Zazen; Shobogenzo Bendowa, which is the chapter we looked at this morning; Shobogenzo Makahanya Haramitsu, that's the second chapter in the book; Genjo Koan, the third chapter in the book. And then he wrote this Gakudo Yojinshu. So sometime between the age of 27 and 33, so it's one of his early works, when he come back from Japan and it was
cocky
yes
record of how it was received? I mean, so it's one of these people he's talking about picking this up. Did they sort of get outraged and create a big thing about? We don't know.
I don't know.
The last sentence, when he describes a true master, that's something very special. It's extraordinary power.
That's what it sounds like, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But we better start looking, haven't we?
What does he mean by transcending his own opinion?
Transcending. What does transcending mean?
Going beyond.
Okay.
Not being stuck in your views.
Okay.
You're relying on experience rather than intellectual concepts.
Okay. There you are then.
Is what it says to me.
Yeah. It doesn't say he doesn't have an opinion.
No. Maybe to have an opinion, not see that it's not. It's only an opinion. It's only one way of looking at things.
I met people who transcend their own opinions, but a lot of things like I never seen before.
Pardon?
But I've met people who transcend their own opinion.
Yeah.
Allow for other people's opinions to be discussed. I met people like that, but I have never met anybody of extraordinary power and unrestricted mental vigor, who never lingers in states of in emotional states. Like everybody seems to get stuck in them for a while.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah,
not linger in states of emotional consciousness.
Yes.
What's he talking about?
Not lingering in states of emotional
consciousness.
Don't linger in them. does not linger in states of emotional consciousness. So it means don't linger in the state of emotional consciousness. So maybe a couple of hours is okay, and then move on. We don't know what his criterion for linger was. Maybe 2 days.
But it evokes someone who doesn't get stuck.
Sounds like it, doesn't
it? It evokes someone
ability to move on.
Who's in a living state of the present is what it evokes.
Yes.
I
it
mean,
also evokes idealistic images, doesn't it? That's the problem for us.
But we meet people like that all the time, don't we?
Yes.
I mean, I met one just before I came here, the electrician who's rewiring our house. No, really, I'm serious.
Yeah.
And he doesn't get, if you talk to him about complicated words, he wouldn't know what you were talking about.
Yeah.
But give him a load of cocked up wiring and he'll sort it out.
Right.
Which is what he's doing, I hope.
With extraordinary vigour. Well, if we read this, we have to notice how we idealise descriptions. We read something and we create an idea. So in the end, we have to look at the idea we've created and say, could it mean something a bit more realistic than that? Or is Dogen really talking about somebody superhuman? Because he's talking about himself too, isn't he?
Isn't he? I mean, yeah. So how is he like a carpenter then? How are the students like pieces of work? If he's talking about himself, How does he operate on people like a carpenter?
Maybe he's not a master here yet. He just came back. He's more like talking about his own master. He came back to China.
Well, you know, like if you want to, if you've got a piece of rough wood that's just come out of the sawmill, first thing you have to do is to smooth it down and make sure it's straight. So it's a metaphor, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to use it as a metaphor. I don't think he means that you should knock the rough edges off people, literally, but we use that phrase, that knocked the edges off him. He's a more rounded person now.
With the simile, fine wood, it makes the student, and just generally throughout this passage, it makes the student seem very passiveness, you know, the whole kind of thing reeks of the student basically having nothing to do with it.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah, you seem to put quite an onus on yourself.
Well, maybe he's touting for students. This is his PR.
But in many ways, he wasn't like that, was he? Because he reflected on a lot of things in an extremely profound and complex way, using language in a very rich tapestry of images and ideas.
Yes.
So,
yeah, I mean, he died when he was 53 years old,
yeah.
And we read one page and we want to define the man from one page.
Mm.
Mm. There's also, I think, implicit in here is that, I think it was in traditional China, that if you, the role of student and master, it was kind of, it was absolute. If you became a student of the master, then you didn't question them, then you followed them absolutely.
Yeah.
Maybe, from a more modern sense, that you would be more critical of something, taking on the teacher, you would sort of, you wouldn't invest quite so much of them as you might have had to, or in social circumstances of the day would have led.
It's possible,
to,
yes.
Yeah.
Certainly Japanese society was and still is quite hierarchical. Not always patriarchal, but hierarchical, certainly. But our own society is hierarchical in a different sense. We just don't notice it. Our hierarchy is in cleverness.
Mm.
So yeah, I mean, you can read parts of that and think, oh, right. Cocky, as Tom said. Doesn't seem to have much to do with the student. But there again, he's writing about looking for a master.
Isn't the sort of Japanese student-teacher thing is very different from what we understand from school? Because I'm thinking of martial arts where the master is a sort of a teacher and leader and
it's true. It's cultural difference.
Yeah. And the teaching is very different. It can be very simple. They will not tell you the truth. You have to figure it out yourself. But they will.
And it can be
guide you in the right direction.
Much less subtle. For instance,
yeah.
I had an argument with my teacher about something, and he said, "So you better leave Dogen Sangha." So I said, "I'm not going to, I'm your student." So he said, "Well, okay, you can stay as long as you obey the rules of Dogen Sangha." So I said to him, "What are the rules of Dogen Sangha?" And he said, "Anything I say." He's really said that. Really said that. So there is that. But then, there again, in Western culture, we're the opposite.
Mm.
Students can criticise, contradict their teachers, and expect that to be okay. You know, you can have a teacher who's long experience for tens and tens of years, and a cocky student who is very, very clever can say something. He might be right, but that's the system we have, isn't it? With its great benefits and its shortcomings too.
I think in the ancient Chinese culture, they would consider a teacher more important than your parents. That's how they thought. They thought, like, you know, the teacher,
yeah.
Who's, you know, whatever he teaches, is almost like more important than your parents.
Strange, that, because when I have retreats in Slovakia, there are some people who have been studying with a teacher who comes through the Deshimaru tradition called Kaisen, and he's very charismatic, and he told them, your teacher is more important than your parents, more important than your children, more important than anybody else in your life. So they asked me if it's true. No, it's not true. I don't know how. No, I didn't say it's not true. I said, how can a teacher be more important than your children, or your partner, or your parents?
I think it's very different. Like back then, like in ancient China or Japan, I think the teacher had a really special kind of status.
Yeah.
I don't think it's the same now. Nobody would think that. But I think back then people did think it was like very important that the teacher would guide the students.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So it was sort of something you dabble in, was it? I mean.
No. Well, especially for Dogen, I mean, he was teaching young men who'd left their homes and come to live in the temple in the wilderness.
Yeah. And that's what you'd have to do if you want to study this stuff. You'd have to do this complete life, completely change your life. And
yeah.
Give everything up. And
it wasn't a lifestyle option.
No.
No.
Leaving class.
No, that's right. Very different.
But it's quite a... almost a koan. If you're an ordinary person and you are doomed unless you find the right teacher, and a teacher has to have all these qualities, you're hardly in a position to assess how are you ever going to start the whole thing.
Good luck. Good luck with the koan. That's what he says. And we have to interpret it through our own glasses as best we can. And take on board those things which we think make sense, and try to understand the differences between the cultures and the times.
It's almost like implying you have to know what Buddhism is before you can study Buddhism.
Well, the thing is, we do.
Yeah.
This is the point.
Yeah.
So people who know nothing about Buddhism or anything and join our group, to me, are always
more authentic.
More welcome, I suppose. Than somebody who comes like coming with your glass full up to the top and saying, "Would you put something in my glass?" You know, they've already decided what it is they believe in and what they don't believe in, and if what you say will go into their cup, then they'll take it. And if so, they're already fixed. Where somebody like I was when I met my teacher, a bit confused, not quite sure why I came, not quite sure what he was saying, that was much can be much easier.
And did he startle you with his earthiness, his down-to-earthness? Who?
Nishijima?
Yeah. You know, his kind of direct earthiness. He was a...
It didn't startle me. But,
or stimulate you, though.
Yeah, stimulate, yes, certainly. Yeah, and his directness.
Because that's what comes across here at the end here. It reminds me of that, and I can't remember which bloke it was, but you know the story about the transmission... from one master to a disciple, or whatever they're called, follower, student.
Yeah.
He was the bloke that was working in the garden and just doing things, you know, chopping the wood and doing...
What, yes.
Is it the sixth patriarch, the fifth patriarch?
Yeah. Daikan Enno. Yes.
Makes me think of that when I'm looking at that, that earthiness. He's not the bloke with all the knowledge and loads of books. He's
well, that's right. He says it's running through that... is that whatever it is that you're looking for has nothing to do with knowledge, cleverness, intellectual understanding. That's very difficult for us because we are immersed in knowledge, intellectual understanding, cleverness. Immersed in it. I went through school in the 1950s and I left school with the impression that to be clever was to be up here, and if you weren't clever, you did woodwork with Mr. Block. You know, that was my kind of take on the world when I left school. And he's saying something different. basically saying the electrician might be quite an enlightened person. As long as he does the wiring right.
Or the footballer, or
anybody, really.
Yeah.
Who knows? You just got to peer around and then decide.
But it's this phrase vigorous, the vigorous road.
Yes,
getting
well,
the vigorous body out instead of being trapped in an intellectual sphere of,
well,
how does he put it, empty.
Well, the thing is, to jump out of the intellectual sphere is to be vigorous. It's not, they're not separate things. You're not, you have to be vigorous, then you can jump out of the intellectual sphere. It's, they're the same thing. So when you throw away all knowledge, all the value you give to intelligence and knowledge, you can be vigorous because you can say exactly what comes out of your mouth. Like you do, Mark.
Well, you do.
Yeah, I've heard you do it. Transcending the intellect and being vigorous. You're very good at it. It's a bit of a pain in the arse, but there you go. No, I'm serious. That's being vigorous. Open your mouth and say.
But we do meet people like that a lot. I mean, we meet them, and perhaps we overlook it, that they've
yes.
given us this.
That's right, because we've got a topsy-turvy value system.
And being in the present, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I was with someone the other day, and they'd never been to the National Gallery before. I took them there.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah, all right. But they the point I'm making is they responded. I said the best way of going around here is to just respond to what attracts you. And it brought the whole thing alive for me. I mean,
yeah.
I've been there, you know, loads of times. But you can get trapped in that thing of greatness, you know, the great painting. I've got to like this.
Or even reading the long explanation at the side. And then you forget to look at the picture and you move on to the next explanation. Which museum, even zoos have become like that now. There's the monkey cage and there's this great big long thing about the monkeys and people are going like this. Nobody's looking at the monkeys. And, of course, in the end, you have to add that last sentence from this morning to this piece of paper, don't you? When you're actually looking for somebody as a teacher, how can the words written there be relevant? You can add that to all of his writings. So you can see how in 1227 Dogen found himself in China, came back to a society that he saw as lost, really, and so, I mean, a Buddhist society, this is the society that he lived in, temples, and so he set about, and in the second paragraph of Bendoa he says that he wondered whether he should stay in one place and, you know, do his thing, or wander around like a floating weed. And he decides he'd better stay in one place and get on with it.
He was a nobleman, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's partly explained why he's sort of concerned about the destiny of the country and all this. Stuff.
Maybe.
Well, you, he was born to have an expectation he was going to play a role in the kind of, you know,
Yeah, but it may be he'd never any experience as a carpenter, so he uses that metaphor. Maybe he didn't know what it was like to be a carpenter. He wrote rules for the temple kitchen on how to do the cooking in the temple. But as the son of a nobility, and I wonder if he had any experience of cooking. And then his main student Edjo was also from nobility, so maybe between them they had no experience of cooking. Maybe that's why he was so keen on writing it all down. So there's a man behind this figure called Dogen, who writes all these wonderful explanations, and you shouldn't forget the man. What should we do now for 20 minutes?
Well, can I just ask, so say you become a certain piece of wood, would you, you know, credit the shape of the type of wood you become 100% to Nishijima Roshi?
Yeah. In that sense, yes. But he wasn't the kind, smooth. Yes. He knocked me about a bit.
The rough edges.
Yeah, he knocked my rough edges off.
Do you think it's good to have a teacher who kind of, you know, ruffles feathers a bit?
I don't know whether it's good, it's what happened to me.
Yeah.
Is it going to happen to you? If you may search one out, he's going to knock your rough edges on. If you've been to see Mike Cross, you've already started.
Oh, I spoke to him last time. Yeah, he did rough edges.
Lovely bloke.
So when you were with Nishijima, was it to some extent like getting out of the traps of intellectualization and into something real for you? I mean, did he sort of, like, as it were...
Yeah, I suppose so, yes.
Yeah.
What attracted me was that he wasn't traditional. He didn't tell me to do anything. He didn't criticize me at all. Until he was very old, but he never stopped, but that was to do with his advanced age. He didn't care too much about the rules. He used to take his robe off. If we used to go and sit, and he'd come back in the zendo, come back up to the room where we all shared a room together, he'd take his robe off, drop it on the floor in a pile, and go off to the toilet. And that kind of thing I liked. And then I was interested in what he said, especially what he said about action. Because I met him and became interested in him because of my outdoor mountaineering activities. Which allowed me to transcend my intellect.
But he did in the modern era kind of similar things that Dogen did in his era.
He did, yes.
Upset the establishment,
yes.
Saying that's a load of bollocks.
Yes.
And I remember that. I love that story of yours, which I can't remember the conference. It was a big conference.
It was in San Francisco.
Yeah, and everyone was waffling on about this, that, and the other. And he said it's not like that at all.
No, he stood up and shouted.
Oh, did he?
He shouted. There's a very well known. There was, I don't know whether he's still alive, but a very well-known Japanese Buddhist philosopher, whose name escapes me, but he's written lots of books, and he was giving a seminar it was a Buddhist Christ, the first Buddhist Christian conference. So all the theologians were there and all the great Buddhists were there. Massive great thing in San Francisco, and this guy whose name I can't recall.
Wasn't it?
You're
talking about Masao Abe.
Masao Abe was giving an exposition about emptiness, and right in the middle of it, Nishijima stood up and shouted at him from the audience.
So what did he say? Is there any record of what he actually said?
Well, I was there, but I can't remember clearly. It was 1987, it's a long time ago.
Yeah.
But roughly, he said, that's a load of rubbish. Emptiness is not that at all. You shouldn't be telling people that that's what emptiness is. And then strangely, everybody was shocked. But strangely, a lot of people came up to him after, including Karl Bielefeld, who was has been one of the translators of the Shobo Genzo in the early days.
To speak to him.
To speak to him and say, yeah, right on, man.
So what was the other bloke saying what emptiness was? And
abstract.
Right.
Abstract. He's talking
letting
about
go of the self, you know, identity. I'm not really
remember.
A real this and a real that. I'm nothing. I'm emptiness. That kind of thing.
And Nishijima became so clear that within the Soto sect in Japan, there was a lot of hierarchy, fighting for position, not much zazen, that he wanted to form a new, completely new lineage. And he got together four of his foreign students, and we made a group which we had to decide a name for. So Jeff Bailey, one of his American students then, suggested Dogen Sangha. And Nishijima Sensei said, I don't think I can say Dogen without saying Master Dogen. So we explained that you couldn't really have Master Dogen Sangha. So we discussed it a lot over a few weeks, and then he said, so that's how Dogen Sangha came into being as a group outside the Soto sect.
With all its institutionalized association.
With all its, yeah. He wanted something to make a clean break from all that stuff.
Mm.
Since it has started to creep back into it again, so now we've got Dogen Sangha groups here and there, run by people I've no idea who they are, who wear beautiful golden robes, and doing wonderful things with groups of people, having completely lost that spirit which we started with.
In what way? What sort of emphasis on ritual again, emphasis on the trappings?
Yeah. So Nishijima didn't want to get rid of all the tradition, but he didn't care much for it. He didn't ever recite the Hanya Shingo until his secretary, Taijun, she went off for 2 years to train as a nun, because she wanted to. And when she came back, she was a proper nun. And she said, you've got to do the Hanya Shingo. So he said, okay. So then they started doing it.
What's the Hanya Shingo?
It's chanting the Heart Sutra.
Oh, yeah. Is that the same, what we used to do up in Glasgow?
Do it in Glasgow.
Yeah,
John does it in Glasgow, yeah. If you like singing, it's
Dai
nice.
Dai Sai Ganapu.
Yes, that's it.
That's the rope chant.
Right.
Oh, I see.
Same principle.
Was that?
But we used to do it in the Glasgow group. every session.
Yeah.
Before something, anyway, chanting.
You know the Heng Shing Yun? Can you chant it? You must have been doing it for 3 months.
Yes, well, I was reading it off a bit of paper.
Oh, okay.
Do it in Japanese one day and English the next, alternate.
Oh, right.
How could they build Soto Shu based on this kind of writing, with like a straight face?
Well, they didn't read it. That's easy.
Doesn't it seem just like inherent? Every time there's someone like Dogen or Nishijima who goes, okay, no, people are getting caught up in triviality, they sort of rebel against them, you know, be like, no, strip that all away. And then there seems to be like an inherent degradation after that point.
Yes, interplay.
Get a grubby mix on it and then make it into a thing that you can do.
Yeah.
And it just follows this.
Yeah, the Lord.
People want it. People want trappings. And
yeah, they do.
Yeah, that's why.
They love it.
Yes.
Makes things not so quite so severe and stark.
And of course, it exists in all so-called religions. I mean, thinking of obviously Catholicism, but of course, if you go into a church, a Catholic church, you meet real Christians who are doing selfless giving to others, and they don't make a big song and dance about it. You don't actually hear about them unless you go in there and meet them. I mean, I have met them. No, but I'm serious. But you know,
I know
people
you're serious.
Are doing sort of really wonderful things. I mean, I remember Deirdre in Glasgow, who would go white with fury if you referred to an addict, a drug addict, as a junkie. She would literally spontaneously say, "Don't speak like that about my brother." You know, she saw everybody as her brother and sister, really. I mean, and lived it. And spent hours and hours collecting stuff and giving it, you know. But it's just an example. And then, you know, over the other side of the axe or whatever it is, there was all the ritual going on and all the... But she's there, you know.
One minute. Or, you know, 5 minutes if you want.
If you want to read the other nine sections that he writes, it's quite nice. And I'm not sure whether it's on Dogen Sanger website, but it should be.
So what is lineage? So
lineage?
Right, yeah, Nishijima for the Samaki, and then how could these rebels survive for so long?
How could
these rebels survive for so long? Like, could a Savaki must have had a teacher who taught him this kind of Buddha? It was mainstream in the 19th century?
No, it wasn't.
So it was never mainstream?
It's never been mainstream, I wouldn't... No, probably not. But there was one Buddhist teacher who bridged from the 1800s to the early 1900s, called Nishiharu Bokuzan, who was a well-known Buddhist teacher, and Kodosawaki learned from him indirectly, and he studied. The thing was that people didn't read the Shobo Genzo, so they lost any idea of what the teachings were.
They've lost for many years.
Pardon?
Were Dogen's writings lost for many years?
I think that I read that they put them all in a box and...
Yeah, they weren't looked at again until I was...
Yes, presumably because they're quite difficult to understand.
Yeah. So the sect kind of evolved independently of them. I guess even though he was the founder of it, they weren't sort of based on his sort of writings or teachings.
I can't tell you how much it diverged. The two diverged, what Dogen originally taught and what actually happened, but something survived. And I only know back as far as Nishiyaru Bokuzan, because there's some stuff written about his life and what he did, and you can trace his teaching through to the modern times. I'm not a historian or a scholar, so my knowledge is pretty patchy, really.
Kodosawaki wasn't his student.
No, Kodosawaki taught at, do you remember the university? There was a Buddhist university that Kodosawaki became one of the professor there. Oh, crumbs. Sorry, my memory's so bad. And there was a teacher there who studied with Nishiyaru Bokuzan, so there's a kind of link through. And Shinryu Suzuki also.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of thin line. I don't know whether it'll always be a thin line.